It's now time to begin the formal part of the proceedings. I'd like to start by acknowledging the Indigenous custodians on the land we meet, and particularly welcome Auntie Roz, who's with us today. Auntie Roz is a good friend of the university, and we've seen a lot of her lately, but it's particularly pleasing to have her at this lunch. I'd also like to welcome everyone who's come from different parts of the university. It's a terrific mix of people, and I also understand we have some colleagues from QUT with us today. So a particular welcome to our QUT colleagues. And, of course, a particular welcome to Desiree Scott, our local member, to the Chancellor, and to Elena Itzen, who's the principal of Logan Lee High School. It's wonderful to have such occasions when we come together really in conversation. We make so few opportunities these days in universities simply to take time to talk to one another about the issues that really matter, and to talk in a way which is a conversation in which all of us are engaged, which involves our community as well as, if you like, the academics simply speaking to one another, or indeed instructing and sharing their knowledge with the students. That makes today a special occasion. It's also a special occasion because we're very privileged to have Dr. Chris Sara with us as our special guest to talk with editor of Griffith Review, Julianne Schultz. I'm sure Dr. Sara is known to many of you, really because he is one of those individuals who's made quite an extraordinary contribution in what is really a very short period of time. Chris, if I may call you Chris, is the youngest of 10 children. And when I saw that, I thought, now I understand how he's been able to achieve something. Because I'm sure growing up in an environment where you're one of 10 means that you have to learn a whole range of life skills which are indispensable in your professional context. Chris has worked in many positions. He has been a PE teacher in the Queensland Department of Education, an education officer and manager of Aboriginal Employment and Education Programs for DEET, an administrative services officer for the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet, a career and guidance counsellor for the Queensland Department of Education, and lecturer for the University of Southern Queensland. In 2003, Chris won Australian of the Year Regional Local Hero Award for Queensland and was named in the Bulletin Smartest 100 People in Australia, which saw him recognised as one of the top 10 educators in the country. This is really nicely embarrassing, isn't it, Chris? It doesn't stop there. In 2004, Chris was named the Suncorp Metway Queenslander of the Year and was also presented with a Dedley Award for his contribution to Indigenous education. In 2004, he also received the QUT Faculty of Education Alumnus Award and the Vice-Chancellor's Outstanding Alumnus Award. But really, I suppose what most of us know Chris for is the extraordinary transformative work that he did and is continuing to do, starting with his work as principal of Sherbrooke State School, where he wasn't willing to accept the status quo and he believed passionately in the change that needed to happen. He facilitated many changes that saw an increasing participation of students in the school and dramatically increased school attendance and, importantly, community involvement in education. Under Chris's leadership, the school became nationally acclaimed for its pursuit of the strong and smart philosophy. Chris is currently director of the Indigenous Education Leadership Institute based at Sherbrooke, which is designed to pursue improved student outcomes for Indigenous children. I'm sure there will be much that Julianne and Chris will talk about which is of great relevance to all of us. I think one of the important things about these lunches is that it helps us to put in perspective some of the small challenges that we face on a day-to-day basis when we hear from people who face much greater challenges and have achieved extraordinary outcomes. So I'll hand over to Chris and Julianne. Thank you.
So you're suitably embarrassed by this?
Yeah.
Maybe the way to start would be just if you could tell us a little bit about what you found when you first went to Cherbourg and just take us through that process a little bit, because...
Sure. If you don't mind, I'll start by honouring the traditional owners of the land as well, and the elders that have come, also Bonnie Robertson, who's out there as well, and just express my thanks for being in your zone. So, yeah, getting back to your initial question about Cherbourg School, it was a school that, it's an Aboriginal school, and for anybody who doesn't know, it's 300 kilometres, about 300 kilometres northwest of here. Mm-hmm. So it was a school that looked like lots of other Aboriginal schools throughout the country that I've seen, a school in chaos where morale of the children was very low, and strangely the morale of the teachers at the school wasn't as low, but had to be nudged, I think, given that there was an ongoing data suggesting that the school was continually failing, and that's what frustrated me. It was a school where there was children were literally, and I mean running up and down on top of the two-storey buildings. It was nothing for children to be swearing at the teacher or those kinds of things. I even copped a few swear words myself from children. And the academic results were continually abysmal, you know, just the kinds of results that we'd never accept in a white school. Mm. So it wasn't a particularly nice place to be.
Had you asked to go there? I mean, how had you ended up there?
For some reason, I'd always had in my mind that I wanted to run an Aboriginal school and try Aboriginal approaches to doing things, or what I thought at the time were Aboriginal approaches, and apply Aboriginal leadership. And having gone through it, I've come out the other end wondering if it was just leadership and getting on with the job.
So did you have a sense of what Aboriginal leadership would mean in that environment when you went in? I mean, did you have a template that you were working to, or were you just following?
Not really, no. Prior to going in there, I just would reflect on the way that we had done things, how we had been disciplined when we were children, running around the place and swimming in the creek, when the old people were playing cards, if we played up, those kinds of things. And it made me wonder about whether or not schools were going a little bit too soft, I suppose, and whether or not we should be revisiting the types of things our old people had to say and honouring that and seeing if that got results. Mm.
So was the environment you went into worse than you'd expected? I mean, or was it more or less what you'd expected?
No, it was pretty much what I expected. Yeah. But there was another dynamic unfolding in my life at the time, I suppose, and that is I was lecturing at the University of Southern Queensland, and it's a very conservative place. And in every job that I've done, I suppose, up until that point, it was about trying to get teachers in schools to better understand ways of doing things with Indigenous children. And I guess I got to a point of frustration at the University of Southern Queensland where you'd be talking about just different strategies that you could try with Indigenous children, only to find that the response from some 18-year-old kid off some property at the top west would say, yeah, that's fine, but... are you like a qualified lecturer? And it used to frustrate me intensely, just this kind of racism or this limited sort of perspective of who we are as Aboriginal people, pervading thing. And it's not only places like Toowoomba as conservative as it is. And I should be honest, I had considered not coming today because of the things that had happened with Mrs. Barton a couple of weeks ago. But that kind of racism has to be called and acknowledged. Ultimately, I decided, obviously, to turn up today because people have to identify that. It frustrates me and it exacerbates the problem when we say that racism doesn't exist in our society. You know, this old lady is a classic example of that. You know, and it's an Indigenous issue, that has very little to do with Aboriginal people. It's got more to do with white Australia than it does with black Australia. So getting back to the University of Southern Queensland, I just thought, blow this, you know. I picked out some other words in my mind, but I thought, I don't need this this kind of rubbish. Yeah. Why don't I just get on with, instead of telling people what they can be doing, why don't I just get on and do the stuff that I'm talking about and get on with my journey and the journey of our children. Mm. And if people follow, then that's what they'll do.
Yeah.
If they don't, oh, I don't really care. I was that fed up with it, to be honest. Yeah. And as it turns out, we're in demand all over the country now. So.
Yeah. Part of that is about a collusion, isn't it? I mean, it's a collusion about between the sort of an expectation of failure and an expectation of, well, you know, there's an expectation of failure and an expectation of this is what's going to happen, you know, and that collusion, which I mean, it seems to me is underpins a lot of the attitudes that you're referring to.
And both of us are guilty of it, I should say. White Australia is guilty of colluding with this very negative perception and this very negative stereotype of what being Aboriginal is. But I should say that Aboriginal Australia is often found guilty of aspiring to that negative sort of stereotype of what being Aboriginal is. And both sides have to be challenged about that. And to give you the best example, it's one of those things when we see Aboriginal people being successful or cutting it in a modern world, we get sliced a bit and people say, oh, well, you think you're too flash for us, or you think you're too deadly, or you think you're white. And it's something that's really hurtful to you because it's not something, you're not aspiring to move beyond notions of being Aboriginal. We'd never pretend that we wanted to. We're always walking in a white world with Aboriginal boots on. So there's none of that. But then I guess you get to a point in your mind where you think people will say those kinds of things because they've got the wrong idea of what really being Aboriginal is about. It's not about lying in the gutter. It's not about wagging school. It's not about failing at school. It's about the things that I look at when I see pictures of my old people. You know, they stand with fierce pride in their eyes and a degree of sophistication and even those photos that we see of people chained up or locked behind fences, they're there, all right.
Yeah.
And it's easy for white Australia to think that they're locked up. But in actual fact, you see the faces in those people. They know they're not locked up. They know that when the fences come down, it'll be white Australia that's set free, not them.
If you look at some of those very early photos, I mean, the defiance in the eyes, you know, it's, you know, and the pride in the standing and so on. I mean, it's very compelling.
And one day we'll understand that.
Yeah. So one of the things that you've obviously done very deliberately is to engage with a very positive sense of being Aboriginal as part of the sort of process. And that's something which you've been criticised for as well. I mean, that's been quite threatening. I mean, I'm sort of interested in how you sort of work that through.
Yeah. Look, the first thing I said to kids at our school on the very first parade, I said, the most important thing that you will learn from me is that you can be Aboriginal and you can be successful. And I think that is probably the most important thing, is I challenged what they believed being Aboriginal was about. You know, it's fair to say that some kids thought it was normal for them. It was a part of being Aboriginal to go and sniff petrol or to drop out of high school before Easter time of grade 8. They thought that was the normal way. And so by taking that on and challenging that and calling that, I confronted those perceptions. And I suppose we did more than that. It was about confronting that perception but also providing a different perception, a new reality for them to become aligned with. And I guess that's where the emergence of the strong and smart motto came. It said it's not about this, it's about the strong and smart, and this is what you should be aspiring to. You know, this is what our old people talk about. He's the real deal over here. Don't be tricked into aspiring towards this identity, or don't collude with that. That identity is one that's being created for you and for us by white Australia with very limited sort of perceptions of who we are and what we can do.
So take us through the steps that you went through. I mean, you obviously had this sort of vision of or a sense of what you could achieve in this environment. I mean, you had the inspiration of a sort of notion of respect for the old ways of you know, for the value of respect as a larger part of it. I'm interested in the sort of process that you went through in terms of taking the children with you, taking the community with you, and then I guess the relationship with the teachers, because that's obviously a really major part of that sort of transformation.
I guess with a lead-in like that, it was very challenging for a lot of people. And implicit within that was the belief that our kids could be just as good as any other kids in the state, and to the extent that that was explicitly named in our strategic document.
So you work, I mean, because people are often very sceptical about the value of working out strategic plans and mission statements and value statements, and I'm sure everyone here has been through that at one point or another, but in your case, that actually seems to have borne real fruit.
I should admit, I'm guilty of that. I find all that strategic document stuff very sexy. I know that's a bit sad, but I actually don't mind that kind of stuff.
But you're somebody who's got a good result from it. I mean, there are plenty of people who've just got the empty words.
And you can imagine that sending shivers all over my body. So I just wanted to be explicit to the extent that it says the aim of Sherbrooke School is academic outcomes that are comparable to any other school in Queensland, and to nurture and develop a strong and positive sense of what it means to be Aboriginal in today's society. It was necessarily a twofold aim, because it's not about, I didn't ever want to run a school that was just about academic results and trying to pretend, you know, like, oh, we're all Australians in our school. I wanted to embrace their identity positively so that they knew what it was about. If it's only just, if you only just focused on academic outcomes, then it's kind of like we're rounding up a whole bunch of black kids and turning them into being like white kids. Mm. And no school should be about that. I mean, every school should show courage here and embrace Aboriginal identity for the positive and sophisticated and truly remarkable thing that it is. And I think the reason we lack the courage to do that is because perhaps we're all a bit misinformed up here about what it actually means to be Aboriginal. You know, it's too easy to hook into the negative stereotype. If we can understand that that's a long way from what it's really about, and got on with the stronger, smarter sort of aspects of it, then we'll see some profound change in our country.
Do you think that was something that you were able to lead, being an Aboriginal person yourself, and being from, and you know, that give you a certain authority in terms of trying to take the community and the children with you? I mean,
yes and no, Julian. There are some benefits to being Aboriginal in that kind of environment, but I won't pretend that it was all easy. I mean, I took some knocks. Because of that, and again, it links back to how we see other Aboriginal people. Some people thought that I wasn't a qualified principal and those sorts of things. And I used to, you know, people would come and visit and look around and say, oh, is the principal here? And
like the kids in the lecture theatre.
And you wanted to say yes, but were you looking for somebody white, were you, or that kind of thing? So that existed, and we just had to call that and make it explicit for the kids to make sure that they were understanding what was right about being Aboriginal.
Mm-hmm. So just going back to the sort of processes of that, I mean, did you build a group of allies in the community, or was it amongst the staff? I mean, you know, this isn't something that you can go in and do, you know, single-handedly. It's obviously a building of alliances and support as well.
Yeah, I got to the school in August of 1988. It seems a long time ago.
98,
I beg your pardon. Just seen a few.
You too. I thought you'd achieved an awful lot in a short time.
No, 98 it was, sorry. And when I went there, I had all black hair. I didn't have any greys. It's a different story when I finished. There's all sorts of thoughts running through my head at the moment. But I guess I sort of went there and just soaked it up for a bit, and I had the luxury of doing that between August and the end of the year, just to see what was real and what wasn't, and to soak it up. But among the first things I did was connect with the power brokers in the community. You know, in the first day I was at the Sherbrooke Community Council, just to acknowledge them as key allies in trying to achieve good things for the school, to honour that, and also to get in partnership with them. Basically.
But were they quick to share your vision, or were they imbued with this sort of underachievement sort of?
No. I think they really appreciated it. It was like a breath of fresh air to them. And I said, I was very frank with them. I said, look, I won't be living on Cherbourg. I'm going to live out of town. I ended up living in a small farmhouse just to have some space. I said, you'll get your pound of flesh out of me. I'll be working hard here. I haven't come with the big flash degree pretending that I know everything. These are your children and they deserve the school's best, and I'm here to give them my best and give them the school's best. And they appreciated that because they're not giving us their second-rate children or anything like that. So we shouldn't be giving them second-rate education. I should also say that underneath all of this was my own experiences with school. And I just know, having been sold short by a school system and then getting to a point where I actually started to believe in myself, just how bad schools can be for children and how schools can really lock kids away with their throwaway comments about them or their attitudes towards black kids or smelly kids or Asian kids or those kinds of things. We can really lock kids for the rest of their life, and we've got to be really careful about that. And I wanted to make sure that I wasn't running a school that was about locking kids away, but was more about helping them to set themselves free.
So you built that support quite early on. I mean, then I guess the next challenge was in terms of the teaching staff, and that was presumably quite a difficult sort of exercise.
Yeah, there was another part before that, and that was connecting with elders in the community. Mm. Because the school was so chaotic, it was just awful. Mm. And again, to honour their role in the community and their significance and importance, I'd engaged them, and we gave a small gift to them that was... It was all about symbolism, you know. It was a stick with an Aboriginal design on that was attached to a key that we had painted gold, and we said, "It's what this symbolises is the old and the new here, and the old being the stick, the traditional like message stick that's used to give you access to places, and the new symbolism is the key that in a new world gives you access to places." We gave that to each of the recognised elders in the community. And said, you have it's open door for you. You can come in and walk into any classroom you like. You don't have to come and sign in at the office or anything like that.
Had they previously had much contact with the school?
Very little at all. So that occurred. And it was good just to have those discussions and to see their involvement. They were very enthusiastic and they had a very calming effect on the whole school. I think that's perhaps one of the most significant things that kind of clicked the school into gear. Having that period just to reflect and see what was real and what wasn't, and talk to the elders in the community, talk to parents and talk to the council. By the time I got into 99, I said to the staff that I'd inherited, look, what I believe is that these children can leave this school with academic outcomes that are just as good as any other child in Queensland. That is, grade 7 children from this school should have a standard that is the same as grade 7 children from any other school. And that we can also send them away from here with a very strong and very positive and very accurate understanding of what being Aboriginal means.
As an extra thing, in a way.
As an extra, yeah. As an essential.
Yeah.
And I said, if you don't believe it, then you should go. Mm. And half the staff left. They didn't get up and walk out of the room then and there. But within a couple of weeks, they had their transfer papers on my desk. And that was a bit of a daunting time because...
Had you expected that?
I'm not really sure what I expected at the time. I just knew that it was going to be tumultuous because I had to create some sense of crisis so that we could come out differently at the other end, because we've been just chugging along, and these guys, some of these people have been there for 8 years.
Did they argue with you? I mean, did they?
Oh yeah. Okay. Don't worry.
And what was it? What was their argument? That you were kidding yourself?
Yeah, they thought I was off with the fairies, and I had to argue with the union and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I'm a union man myself, but against this background, I think they had it, particularly in relation to the fights with the union. It was about they were about protecting the staff who I had considered were incompetent staff, were not delivering outcomes, and had been doing so for years and left unchallenged. Mm. The union had jumped in and set about defending them, when I had argued they should be jumping in and setting about defending our profession, the education and teaching profession, which is a magnificent profession that needs defending from people who don't believe in the capacity of children to learn. Mm. So I had those kinds of fights, and the teacher was, just basically told me to back off. They said, we've been here for, some of us have been here for 8 years, you've got no idea what it's like, you've just blown in. And the community accepts us and all of this kind of stuff.
And was part of their line, well, this is what you can expect. I mean, had any of those, had they attempted to build bridges with the community in many cases?
Yeah, look, some built bridges, all right. They, the kinds of bridges that communities didn't want.
Yeah.
I'm saying that there were some staff that were drinking and spending nights in the community and stuff like that, thinking that by doing that, they were connecting with the community and thing. I mean, they were connecting all right, but not in the way an educator...
Not an appropriate way.
A respected professional should be connecting. Mm. And I was horrified, and the council had been horrified about that, and it just wasn't on. So, they were telling me to back off. And then I would ask them, why is it? Why are we seeing this failure? Why am I seeing 100% of kids recognised as below state average in literacy every year, and yet when you give me the planning, it looks the same as what you gave me last year? Mm. Kids are failing, you're doing the same thing. That saying, if you always do what you always did, you always get what you always got. We needed to do something dramatically different, so I guess that's why we set about creating that sort of chaos that Dr. Wilkinson always talks about. But that's another story. So I just needed a team that believed what I believed and believed what the council believed and believed what the elders and parents wanted to believe.
And so in terms of getting new teachers, I mean, were you actively recruiting, or did it depend, I mean, was it just a matter of then depending on who got allocated to the school through the system?
A bit of both. I'd headhunted some teachers. My missus was still lecturing at USQ at the time, and then she agreed that she would... we'd had our first son, Ezra, by that stage, and she'd agreed that she would put her career in the back seat for a while, which I felt awful about, but was tremendously grateful for. I think it's good that people know about that. So I headhunted her for good reason, plus it gets very lonely through the week, out in the bush.
as the other teachers had clearly found.
Well, I completely lost my thought. No. And there were a few people around that I'd headhunted, but most of it was I went into district office and said, look, I need a couple of male teachers on staff. I need people who are the best quality, like the S1s, and people who can just get on with it. So we looked at the screen and we checked out a couple of names, and this person had an interest in sport, this person had an interest in special ed, and I said, let's give this one a try and let's give that one a try.
Mm-hmm.
And this was towards the latter part of 99 now. So
you've had a year of chaos.
Chaos, all right. So we got on the phone to them, and I would suss them out and say, look, it's not like any other school you've been to. It's going to be very hard work, but I will stand by you, And some said to me, look, I haven't met any Aboriginal people. I don't know much about Aboriginal culture, Aboriginal people. And my response to that was this: I don't care.
No.
I'm not looking for experts on Aboriginal stuff, because I'm surrounded by a whole community of experts on Aboriginal stuff. What I want here are expert teachers who can just bloody get on with the job and deliver outcomes. Of course, it goes without saying that I expected them to rapidly acquire knowledge about the Aboriginal stuff or what it was about these kids that they needed to know about their cultural and social context. I expected them to go out and visit parents, sit on the front veranda, have a cup of tea with them, talk about their children's background and look around and see the photos that were on the wall and look in some place and see that there's actually no furniture in this place, it's just a rubber mattress on the floor but a flash TV or those kinds of those kinds
of understanding.
Things. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
So that they could understand where kids were coming from.
Yeah.
The other thing I had recruited local Indigenous teacher aides to work alongside these people, because I knew that if I was going to place that expectation on them, then it was incumbent upon me, I suppose, to broker that sense of relationship. Mm-hmm. Because I know it's very challenging for people to contemplate just bowling into an Aboriginal community and lobbing on the front doorstep. Mm-hmm. It's very challenging. Mm-hmm. I recognise that. Mm-hmm. So I'd set up each teacher with, say, an Indigenous teacher aide who was from the community and said, you'll work alongside these people and you'll respect and honour what they have to offer. You know, don't come here with the big flash degree and make them do all your crowd control behaviour management stuff. Mm-hmm. You will honour what they know, because the stuff that they know is just as valuable as the stuff that you got from teachers' college or wherever. And they took to that very nicely, and there were some really good relationships that are still ongoing.
And that presumably was great for the people who you recruited to be the teacher aides. I mean, you know,
I
would assume that the jobs that are available in Sherbourne-Murgon, you know, they're probably not as many as interesting as that.
Yeah, and part of that was the fallout of the manifestation of the good relationship with the council. You know, I managed to convince them that it would be a good idea to put CDEP workers in the school for 3 days a week, and I had given an undertaking to top them up with funding from wherever I could find it to give people a 5-day job. And that was crucial as well, and in fact possibly the most significant thing, because it did a whole range of things. One, it took guys out of the community and gave them a reason to have a shave in the morning, you know, and there's dignity in that. It created very powerful alliances within the classroom, which covered a really broad depth of knowledge that could hook into delivering the best outcomes.
So the kids were concerned that they were people who
absolutely, and the strong and smart that we talked about was there in front of them every day. You know, it's one thing to bring some big time a Kathy Freeman or something like that to the school. That's nice, and it energises the kids and gets them buzzing.
Yeah.
But after a couple of days, the glow is still a bit there, but it's diminishing. Yeah. And then after a couple of weeks, it's completely disappeared.
And by a term, they've forgotten about
it. Yeah, it's a different story when you've got day-to-day role models in front of children every day who sometimes might live in the same house, you know. So they've been in the same sort of lounge room, same kitchen as the kids who are sitting in the classroom.
And presumably for the teacher aide, those people that you recruited into those jobs, I mean, they were getting stronger and smarter by the process of being, you know, having that responsibility and being exposed to the kids and so on.
Yeah, and there were challenges there as well. You know, I had to... Most of the people who I tried out in the school were successful, because I had high expectations of them also, and I said, look, I don't want bullshit here. I want these children deserve our very best, you know. That if we want strong and smart, then we have to deliver strong and smart for them as well. We can't say strong and smart and then let them see us on the charge or not coming to work because we're hungover or something like that. So tell me now, if you can give that, well, let's have it. If you can't, well, move over and let me put somebody else in who can deliver that. And they responded to that mostly. Some didn't. Some left. But that's okay.
Yeah, well, it happens everywhere. So that's the community and the teachers that you've covered. But now tell us about the children. I mean, in your essay in Griffith Review, you talk about one boy who is sort of smart, but not in the way that smart was regarded, and your exchange with him. I mean, I'd be interested.
Maybe
counterpoint that with some of the others.
That was a kid who was biggest kid, a very good looking kid, biggest toughest kid in the whole school, and very charismatic. And his teacher was one of the teachers that I'd inherited, and she would pride herself in saying, look, I give these kids 3 tasks to do, 2 literacy tasks and a numeracy task, and I just give them their own, they work on that in their own time. So from 9 o'clock till 1 o'clock, they choose whichever task they do. And if they finish those 3 tasks, then they get free time from 2 till 3. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, you're telling me if kids finish in a school where kids there is chronic failure... If a kid finished 3 tasks in the morning, then they get an hour off every afternoon. Like, that's 5 hours free time in a school that is failing dismally. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't stack up. Mm-hmm. So this was his teacher, and
if you tell us the story of coming into the
classroom. I got into his classroom, and it was chaotic, and it was all. I had spent a lot of time walking around classrooms in the start, and you'd go around in the morning. You might see 8 children by 9:30. You might see 14 by 10 o'clock, and then you come back in the afternoon, and there'd be 3 again. And then you come in the next morning, and there'd be 12, but 6 of those were different to the kids that you saw the day before. Mm. So it was just too sporadic.
Yeah.
Anyway, I visited this classroom one day, and I called this guy. I said, I want to hear you read to me. And he comes over, and he was on edge at the thought, and he sort of puffed his chest up, and he looked at his mates, and then he looked at me, and I said, come on. And it sort of knocked him a bit when I said, I want to hear you read. And he jacked up. But I wasn't going to let up. Mm. I insisted on hearing him read. Anyway, he realised I wasn't going to give up, and he grabbed the book, and he's looking at it. Oh, the wolf said huff and puff and this, that. He was just memorising it.
Three Little Pigs.
Three Little Pigs. This is a grade 7 kid. And I said, all right. I said, now I want to hear you read another one. But this time I'll pick the book. And he said, no. And he was clearly uncomfortable. He says, and he jacked up. He got up. He said, I don't want to fucking read for you anymore or something. I ripped open his fridge and kicked the guts of the fridge. And then he walked off. And we never saw him for the rest of the week. And I just think of that kid. You know, like I've said in the past, you know, the biggest, toughest kid in the whole school would rather get kicked out of school than admit that he couldn't read. Mm. And the fact that he couldn't read wasn't his fault, because he was clearly very intelligent, very bright. Mm. And, those things just didn't happen.
And so were you able ever to bring him back into the fold, or was he too...
Not really, no, because he was in grade 7 at the time, and we just didn't really... He was in grade 7 in 1999, and we just really... There were some times when I felt like I'd gotten to him, you know, and in conversations I'd call some of his behaviour and say, look, I said, this is bullshit what you're showing me, you know, this is... I said, you act like a big man, but what I'm seeing from you is small boy stuff, you know. In our way, blackfella's way, where you are now, you'll be ready to become a man. You'll be going down the track, a boy, and you'll come back a man. I said, but you're just showing me nothing but small boy stuff. And I think that resonated with him because it latched onto his identity in that. But if we could have had another 2 years of those sorts of discussions, and that he wouldn't be in a jail today. That's for sure.
And somebody who was obviously so much potential talent, slipped through.
Yeah.
But so then over the time, I mean, he obviously had some considerable successes with, you know, in transforming both the achievement rates and the retention rates and the, you know, all the rest of it. So.
It's the nicest part of the story, Julian, just reflecting on those individual kids and their own journey. And I, at the launch of our institute the other day, there's a girl called Marilyn who's a superstar, delivered a really powerful speech to the crowd with TV cameras, things, spotlights on her, not daunted one bit. And she delivered a really powerful speech and told us about how she wanted to go on and do law and those kinds of things. When Marilyn was in grade 6, she missed 87 days of school. Mm. And we called that. We said, look, it's not good enough. We want good behaviour from children. We want kids to come to school every day. And I would say to the kids, you know, when we leave school, what are we going to be? And they'd say, strong and smart. And then that gave me the leverage to say to them, you can't tell me that you want to be strong and smart and then go missing from school because you're slack or whatever. Mm-hmm. Your actions have to match up with your words. And I had set sort of goals for them, and I said to the kids in that particular year, when Marilyn was in grade 7, I said, any child who has less than 10 days away from school is going to get a free, is going to get a trip to Melbourne for a week. There's another part to this story that I should explain. Because ordinarily I wouldn't put up the bucks for that sort of a trip, but unfortunately what had happened was we had some, how do you say, do good academic, you know what they're like, no, I'm not. This lady was an academic who blew into Cherbourg, rounded up all the kids who've been quite delinquent, smashing into our tuck shop 3 times in 4 days, bashing some of our kids because they were attending school and
intimidating them,
very delinquent behaviour. She had rounded up these kinds of kids and took them on a trip to Melbourne for some, to visit the Tickford whatever, and it really shook our kids up, because it was sending the wrong message. It sends a message that if you go and smash into the tuck shop or whatever, you can go and get a trip to Melbourne or whatever. So that's why we had a trip to Melbourne, and I had to explain to the kids, this is wrong. You know, that sort of stuff just shouldn't be happening. And the kids were very hurt by it. They were saying to me, you know, like, we come to school every day, we respect our mothers and fathers, and we try to be strong and smart. I might as well go and smash up the complex and I'll get a trip to Melbourne, you know. So that's why we had a trip to Melbourne. there were about 18 kids who had less than 10 days from in grade 7, and Marilyn was one of those. She'd missed, as I said, 87 days in grade 6. She missed 7 days when she was in grade 7. And she went on to aspire to be junior ducks of Mergan High School. She never got there, but she was among the top 3 and 4 students. And it just blows me away when you think of the exponential sort of impact. If we lit her candle like that, imagine how many other kids she'll inspire if she goes on to do law and things like that. And I will say this, we prompted that kind of a seismic shift, if you like, without touching anybody's welfare payment or anything that, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in just finally, we're running out of time, but just finally just exploring that more punitive model, which seems to be gaining favour at the moment, of you know, removing welfare as a stick to getting kids to school. I mean, that's very, it's sort of the antithesis of what you've been talking about, isn't it?
What frustrates me about that the most is that it assumes too readily that the cause of absenteeism from schools resides with Aboriginal people and Aboriginal children, and that's not always. That's just one slither of the whole problem. So I don't have a problem with no school, no pool. If we've been through that process like we went through, where we said, what is it about my classrooms that are so uninspiring that kids don't want to come back every day? And we had to reflect on those kinds of hard questions. And necessarily so, because I think a lot of people forget this. If we're teaching in a school, it says individualised learning, maximise the potential of all students, those kinds of sexy statements. There's no brackets after that that says unless they're black. It's all teachers in classrooms have to be passionate about and believe in the capacity of all children. And if they don't, frankly, they shouldn't be there. So we had to ask those hard questions before we would offer those kinds of incentives. And I know that for a fact, because I've seen it with my own eyes. You know, I've seen it to the extent that you get a change like with Marilyn that I talked about. And I've seen it to the extent that I actually had to send kids home when their family was, you know, I knew that there's a funeral on in their family, and they would come to school, and I said, no, look, you have to be at home with your family. You've got sorry business on. You can't be at school today. You know, you have to be home with your with your family. So, you know, those kinds of things.
So it's a two-way thing. Yeah.
And I won't accept any excuse anymore in this regard. I'm quite rightfully pig-headed about it, I think. I've seen kids suffer the worst kinds of circumstances that you would want to imagine and come to school in the morning. So it just renders all these other sorts of notions bullshit, you know.
Well, and in with your Indigenous Education Leadership Institute, hopefully you'll be able to communicate this message and instill some of these approaches more widely.
Yeah, and we'll do that in, you know, hopefully people will be inspired by the story, and that's the strength of it. But if we have to use a stick, we will. You know.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. That's been marvellous.
Thank you very much, Chris and Julianne. We do have some time for questions, if anyone would like to ask Chris any questions. Yes?
The best thing to do perhaps is direct you to the website. It's www.strongersmarter.eq.edu.au. There's a range of programs that are geared for educators. Some of that is residential type programs where we'll bring principals from around the country to Cherbourg. Some of that is about induction programs that we'll offer to schools around the country. So keep an eye out for it.
So is a question over here?
Same question.
Ditto.
Chris, John Graham from the Maryland.
Hey John, how you going? Good man.
I was interested in your comments about CDP. It's been a passion of mine that I don't think it meets the goals and that for indigenous communities. So you said like you've got a lot of those people in the community away from that stigma of working for the dole. You know, the government stands on the providing CGP as the highest employer of Indigenous people in Australia. Mm. So, what's you got any other comments on that?
Yeah, one of the things that I insisted on was that I didn't want it to be seen as free labour for the school. That I had given that undertaking. Look, if you put them on, I will find the money from somewhere to top them up. And as well as that, I will pay for their training and development. So, as part of the process, we re-established the RATEP program in the school, remote area teacher education program, so that if they chose to, they could engage in tertiary studies to become teachers themselves. And I would say, I would have them on for 25 and 30 hours a week, and I would say, these teacher aides will work till 1 o'clock. After that, they'll be on paid leave to go and do their RATEP studies in the afternoon. So essentially what we did was take them off a work for the dole program and set them on a career path that stops wherever they choose.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my point, that there's no career outcome for people that are on
the Absolutely, yeah, and I'm glad you raised it. Thanks, brother.
Any other questions? Sorry.
What suggestions would you have for faculties of education?
I think we've just got to ram that point home about the believing in the learning capacity of all children in the classroom without the brackets about saying unless they're black, and that if we're going to be educators in a noble profession, then we have to be noble about that and believe in all of the children. It's one of the things that bothers me today is that when you go to a school that's got, say, 70 teachers on staff, you'll find 5 or 6, maybe 10, that are really passionate about the children. You know, you often don't see them in the staff room because they're away cooking up ideas or getting ready for the next lesson or whatever. They're not sitting in the staff room whinging about whatever. But every teacher in the school should be like that. Every teacher should be passionate, you know. And I'm not being out of it when I suggest that, you know. I know that there are times when it gets really tough, you know. But it's just got to be. We've got to recognise and embrace it as the honourable profession that it is, because it is a great one, you know.
Desley,
Chris, I take it that there was a replacement found for you at Cherbourg to carry the torch, and that you're keeping an eye on the school as it continues to foster.
Yeah, there's some. Look, in any sort of transition, there are challenges, and the school is confronted by some challenges at the moment, given the shift in leadership and leadership styles and those sorts of things. It's just something that we've got to get through, and I guess I've got to be content that under my leadership, the school saw how good it could be when things are firing, and the community has a human right to insist on that, and to not accept any slippage. And it's up to the community to expect that. And as a department, we shouldn't be expecting any less. And if there is that slippage, then there should be intervention. That's probably all I could say in fairness. Yeah. Not at the start, but there are a couple of white kids there now who belong to the local pastor. I'm really glad you asked me that question, because I bet you're thinking in your mind, well, how does that mesh then? If you've got a motto that says strong and smart and an aim that says proud to be Aboriginal, how do you accommodate that? And initially my answer is they figure out, and initially I think if they were the kinds of kids that would freak out, they wouldn't be there in the first place. They go to Mergan, which is 5 kilometres up the road, and if they decide to go into our school, then they've got the capacity to work out what the strong and smart is for themselves. And I talked that through with them, because they came when I was there. But it begs the question, and if you don't mind, if we've got the time, I'll throw it around here. Like, if you had your children in my school, what would you expect from me as the principal for your children? I'd be interested to hear some answers thrown at me. Not all at once, though. I guess the question is this: if your children are white children and they came to our school, a school that talks about being strong and smart, young, black and deadly, all of that, what would you want me to change, or what would you want me to do to accommodate them? Cool, thanks. What else?
That everybody would understand that there are some natural questions
mm-hmm.
that children ask about observing the people around them.
Nice.
That my skin is white and speckled, and I don't really read in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them don't, and my son has grown up in a very wonderful environment, and he notices it.
Mm.
And he sometimes works it out, and I think fruitlessly.
Mm.
But he doesn't mean anything by it.
Yeah.
It's just an observation.
Thanks.
And being able to grow in comfort.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So we'd have to be sensitive about the difference. Thanks very much. Anything else?
I think I would feel I would hope that the school would make my child feel welcome, safe, part of the peer group.
Yep.
That the peer group is positive.
Yeah. Yeah. The reason I ask that question is to get you to reflect on the flip side of that and ask, what is it we do when 2 or 3 black kids enroll into a school? And I'll just leave that thought with you.
Or indeed when 2 or 3 black kids enroll in a university. Perhaps.
Yeah.
Perhaps on that note we should finish and take some time for a reflection on those quite profound issues. I'm sure you would agree with me that this has been a very special Griffith Review conversation. I think everything that Chris has said has ways in which it resonates with what we all do, because in some capacity we are all educators in this room. And in that role we have huge responsibilities to our communities, to our colleagues and to future generations who have to be stronger and smarter than we are. So thank you very much for your sharing your experience and for that inspiration. Thank you, Julianne. We have a small gift for you, which might help to make a few people a bit stronger and a bit smarter.
Oh, thank you.
And I draw everyone's attention to the fact that there will now be dessert and coffee served. In conclusion, I'd like to thank our sponsors, the Co-op Bookshop, and our new sponsor, Ceramate Wines. And as always, to thank the Griffith Review team, who've worked really hard behind the scenes, particularly Kathy Wallace and Jim Nyland. And everyone who's actually helped with this wonderful function. I'd also like to commend, if we haven't already succeeded in selling you this edition of Griffith Review. When I read this edition, my response was to think that I wished every educator and every parent in Australia could read this edition, because I think there is so much in it that makes us stop and think about the nature of education, both pre-tertiary and indeed tertiary education, in terms of what it is, what it's looked like in the past, and indeed what it might look like in the future. So thank you for joining us today, and please join us for tea and coffee and dessert. Thank you.